Okay, Ashley, we're just going to have to go and not be able to record the call. I'm not sure what's going on. Please go ahead.
Okay. Good morning and welcome to this month's Hancock Whitney Asset Management Economic Update Call. The information and opinions expressed on this call are those of the individuals who made the statement and do not necessarily reflect the policies, views, opinions, and positions of Hancock Whitney Bank. Hancock Whitney makes no representations as to the accuracy, completeness, timeliness, suitability, or validity of any information presented. This information is general in nature and is provided for educational purposes only. Information provided in statements made should not be relied on or interpreted as accounting, financial planning, investment, legal, or tax advice. Hancock Whitney encourages you to consult a professional for advice applicable to your specific situation. On today's call, we have Chief Investment Officer David Lundgren, who will also serve as our moderator. We have Chief Investment Strategist Paul Teaton and Investment Directors Richard Chauvin, Jeffrey Changas, and Martin Ferreira. With that, I'll pass it on to the moderator, David Lundgren.
Great. Thank you very much, Ashley. Thank you, everyone, for joining this morning. This is our normally scheduled monthly call. We've had two special update calls since last month's call, really as a function of just the tremendous amount of events and market activity that we've seen over the last 6 weeks. And all of our guests today have been in the business for 25-plus years, and I don't think any of us have experienced anything quite like this. And this morning we're hoping to just kind of bring you up to date on where things stand and then provide you some insight on where we go from here. We'll start off with a discussion about the economy. And good morning, Paul. How are you?
Good morning, Dave. I'm fine, thank you.
Great. Paul is our chief investment strategist and really is responsible for overseeing all aspects of strategy and economic forecast for the firm. And Paul, let's go ahead and talk about, we just reached the end of the first quarter. And, you know, when you think about the quarter, really the first 2 months, January and February, the economic data we got out of those months were pretty solid. And then as everyone on the call is very well aware, we kind of came to a grinding halt as a function of, you know, trying to contain the spread of COVID-19. And as a result, you know, we're beginning to see some economic data from the month of March, and it's pretty rough. I guess some of the early numbers we saw related to unemployment claims. And, you know, if you could maybe talk a little bit about the first quarter before we move into the second quarter.
Sure. So as you mentioned, the economy was cruising along pretty well, actually, in January and February. Our expectations were something in the 1.5%, 2% GDP range, real gross domestic product range. And as actually the job numbers, job payroll growth numbers in January and February were a lot stronger than expectations. And so the economy was actually looking better than we expected. And then the trap door opened up and the bottom fell out in March. And so currently it looks like about a zero rate of growth, basically flat real GDP in the first quarter is pretty good ballpark estimate. We won't get that report until late this month, but there are a lot of signals that can give us pretty good clues as to the shape of it, and so that's the assessment today, is flat in the first quarter.
Okay. Let's go ahead and shift to the second quarter, and you know, a lot of economists out there that we follow have some pretty dire forecasts, you know, minus 20, minus 25%, and it's just, you know, like I said earlier, I don't know that any of us have experienced anything like this. So if you could talk a little bit about the jobs report that we got in the last couple of weeks that were, I guess, the real first indication of what April might look like, and then talk a little bit about what you think the second quarter from just an economic, well, contraction, not growth, might look like.
Sure. Well, you're right. This is certainly an unusual situation, and I've certainly never seen such a sharp slowdown and basically the economy coming to a full stop like this. And the first clue was the initial unemployment claims for the week of March 21, which was 3.3 million new claims in that week, which was a stunner in a big way, even in the depths of the 2008 and 9 recession. The weekly unemployment claims never exceeded something like 600,000 or 700,000 in a week. So that was pretty bad. And then the next week, it was 6.5 million. So really, over a couple of weeks, 10 million filings for unemployment insurance is pretty dramatic. So we're having a hard time coming up with exactly what the coronavirus economic disruption would look like in terms of numbers and rate of contraction in the second quarter, and had painted a kind of a worst-case scenario of a 15% decline in real GDP. That's a seasonally adjusted annual rate. The quarterly rate would be really about a quarter of that. But anyway, that's all the convention in the business is to talk about everything in seasonally adjusted annual rates. So 15 was the projection for the contraction in the second, followed by some modest rebound in the fall and continuing recovery next year. And all of that would have given us a year-to-year growth or year-to-year contraction in real GDP at the nadir of around 3% in the summer quarter. Well, the expectations have moved further south. There was an important study released last week by the Wall Street Journal in conjunction with Moody's Analytics, where they studied the damage being done to the economy and counted 82% of U.S. counties enforcing essential service-only work rules, estimated that 29% of the U.S. economy had been idled. And so expectations really have gravitated to in minus 25, minus 30. There are even a few at minus 40% seasonally adjusted annual rate contractions in the second quarter. So pretty stunning turn of events. Looks pretty ugly. It's totally unprecedented. It's interesting that all of those very dire forecasts for the second quarter, and we can see them on Bloomberg. They're all part of the Bloomberg survey, and you can see, Morgan Stanley, J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, everybody else. They all pretty much uniformly are pointing to V-shaped recoveries in the fall. So a really bad second quarter, followed by some kind of pretty vigorous recovery in the fall is the expectation, and have no way to dispute it and say that no, it's going to be different than that. It sure looks pretty ugly.
Yep, no doubt. It's a rough second quarter. Hopefully, get a decent bounce in the second half of the year, and obviously, a lot of that will have to do with our ability to contain the virus, and I know Richard's going to talk about that in a minute. But before we go there, Paul, if you could, there was a very large piece of legislation, $2.2 trillion passed, week and a half ago. And talk a little bit how that might limit the demand shock a little bit in terms of the quarter.
Sure, Dave. So the key question there is, does the CARES package and the other smaller programs that they passed match up to the demand shock? And, how well focused are the programs on limiting the bleed to incomes? And the short version is pretty well, I think. So if you think about the demand shock side of it, the nominal value of gross domestic product last year was around $22 trillion. Expectations, as we're talking, are flat in the first quarter. So we're talking about a contraction from that level. So let's say a 30% contraction in the second quarter, for example, would represent a loss of $6.5 trillion from that $22 trillion level. So the kind of the identity in economics is that everything that's produced, meaning GDP, is somebody's income. So it's $6.5 trillion is the expected annual rate of income loss in the second quarter. That's the key qualifier there is annual rate. So distilling that to actually how much of that would be in one quarter, it gets to minus $1.6 trillion unannualized. So the CARES Act and the other two smaller programs also passed recently altogether amount to about $2.5 trillion of fiscal support for various mandates. Importantly, about $1.8 trillion of that is focused on individuals in one form or another, either paid sick leave or direct payments or expanded unemployment insurance benefits, and the payroll protection program, $350 billion for small businesses to maintain payrolls. So it looks like the scope of the fiscal response is pretty close to kind of the demand shock that we're likely to be dealing with. There's certainly a lot of ifs there. It's not assured that the programs match up perfectly or even well with where the income dislocation is in the economy. Big questions about the gig economy, private contractors who don't have health insurance or any kind of salary contracts are potentially stranded out there. But nevertheless, it seems to be fairly evenly matched. I think we can, if the assumption is that they can gin up the programs, get the money out there, it's going to have a pretty big impact. And as long as the duration of this doesn't last more than, you know, say 3 or 4 months, it should have a pretty positive impact. I would say that the Fed, which Jeff will talk about later, has just done a totally heroic and Herculean job of putting programs in place to support the markets. Just yesterday announced a new program that they would buy small business loans under the Payroll Protection Act, you know, lending a lot of muscle to that particular part of the CARES Act to speed up and accelerate and broaden the impact of that program.
Great. You said a lot of ifs, and there's a lot of variables that you know can impact the second quarter and the second half of the year in terms of economic growth. And one of those is just the ability to actually contain the virus. And Richard Chauvin, are you there?
I am here, Dave.
Hey, Richard is one of our investment directors. He's primarily responsible for asset allocation and due diligence for the firm, but has also really become our healthcare coronavirus expert, has read a lot of research regarding the virus. And Richard, I think, you know, we've gotten a pretty nice response from the market yesterday and then this morning. Getting a little bit of bounce, and I think it has a lot to do with some encouraging news coming out of Europe. So if you could maybe talk a little bit about the situation there.
Certainly, I will do so. So the three countries in Europe that have over 100,000 cases each are Italy, Spain, and Germany. And there are definitely some encouraging data coming out of those countries with regard to the the cases. Just a couple of statistics here. The daily cases are down 45% from the peak in Italy, and that's just over the past couple of weeks. In Spain, the cases or daily cases are down 39% in Spain. That's over the past week and a half. And in Germany, the cases have dropped 53%, and that's just in the past few days. So you might say Germany's a little bit tentative with a lack of data, but it is on a seemingly on a downward trajectory there. The fatalities in those countries are generally down as well, not by as much as those cases, which are obviously, unless another outbreak resurfaces there, those are definitely encouraging trends that the markets have noticed. Couple of other things I'll mention about Europe. There may be some stabilization, plateauing, I should say, going on in the United Kingdom. We've had a peak on the 5th of April and a little bit of a downturn in the cases there. And among other countries in Europe where there's over 10,000 cases each, those would include Switzerland, Belgium, Austria, Portugal. There's also a good trend developing among cases in those countries. So, again, Europe, where the virus first went after China's outbreak, seems that the social distancing policies, lockdowns, seem to have been working there. So all good news.
Okay, and let's just see a little discussion around how that translates over to the U.S., which I guess in terms of, you know, when a lot of the shelter-in-place efforts really took hold, you know, we're maybe a week or two behind where they were in Europe. And, you know, I noticed the models in the U.S. are also looking a little bit more encouraging. Give us a little commentary on that, if you could.
Absolutely. It's a little bit earlier in the cycle here, but we think the same cycle is likely to play out. Obviously, we've got a much larger population and a bigger geographic area to worry about. But the daily case growth really dramatically increased between March 7th, where it was only 116 reported cases. And then on April 4th, there were over 34,000 cases per day on the 4th. Yesterday, that number was off a little bit at 30,300. So a little bit of a peaking, obvious, but we can't hang our hat on those numbers as being an actual real peak yet, but some encouraging news there. We still see the testing as being the limiting factor in really understanding the pattern of infections here and the number of cases. We are definitely still behind in testing versus other countries, but rapidly catching up, and I'll talk a little bit about that. The goal of the U.S. in testing is to have 750,000 tests per day being conducted. We are on the way up, but still at about 133,000 per day, so well below the goal, but up from 28,000 just 2 weeks ago. So we're definitely improving on the case on the testing front. So those are good trends as well.
Good. Well, and you know, successful containment efforts and you know, really flattening the curve, as we've discussed quite a bit, will be helpful in minimizing the damage done to the economy in the second quarter. What's going to be really important, I think, in the second half of the year is that if we, or even sooner, if we get a second wave, or as we move into the fall, we see, you know, kind of a regeneration of the virus, having some sort of antiviral treatments will be critical. Talk a little bit about any advancements that have been made in that space.
Absolutely. So just to kind of put a finer point on what you just said, if Americans have some confidence as they return to work and school, if we know that there's treatments and potentially a vaccine down the road, the behavior is likely to be different, the fear factor less, and so people are more likely to begin to resume their normal activities. Knowing that, the first thing that we can hope for, and it's actually plausible this could happen this summer, is we get one or more effective therapies, drugs that fight the virus but that are not vaccines. And we've talked a little bit about the hydroxychloroquine and the chloroquine drugs, long-standing drugs used against rheumatoid arthritis and lupus, have a pretty good safety profile. There's lots of anecdotal evidence that they're relatively safe, given their long history, and that they seem to be effective. But again, no firm, big, large population studies, but those are underway. For example, in New York, there's an 1,100 patient study underway for those drugs. There's also, fortunately, becoming available is a large supply of these drugs due to the generosity of Novartis. A large pharmaceutical company has donated 30 million doses. Bayer has contributed 1 million doses of the chloroquine drug, which is just a little stronger version of hydroxychloroquine. So those are going to begin to be distributed on the basis of need by the federal government. Beyond the hydroxychloroquine opportunity, we also have a number of antiviral drugs, such as remdesivir that we've talked about by Gilead Sciences, that is being studied. Finally, there's a number of antibody drugs, those that kind of function as the immune cells. They're sort of a synthetic immune cell type treatment, and we've got a number of companies working on those. So just to kind of summarize all that, with the combination of the hydroxychloroquine and some of the other antibody drugs, there's a very strong opportunity for us to have therapies in a matter of months, and that would definitely guard against the possibility of this second wave that you spoke of, Dave.
Okay, great. Hopefully we get continued good news on that front. Thank you, Richard. Martin Serrera, good morning.
Good morning, Dave. How are you?
I'm good. Martin is our Director of Equities and is responsible for overseeing and managing all of the equity strategies that Hancock Whitney Asset Management is responsible for. Martin, it's hard to believe that on February 19th, we were hitting all-time market highs and feeling pretty good about where we were, and I think everybody knows what happened from there. Just an incredible volatile period for stocks. Just give us a little detail about the month and the quarter about recent price movements, if you could.
Yeah, sure, Dave. And that February 19th date that you pinpoint there, the S&P 500 index was up almost 5% for the year, for 2020, in the first month and a half. So the 2019 rally of 30 or so percent had continued right into 2020. And like you said, a pretty remarkable turn of events. Stocks have been somewhat of a thermometer on economic activity here. And as Paul described, anticipating a deep decline in aggregate income in the middle part of 2020, stocks have certainly demonstrated real worries about that decline. For the quarter, the S&P 500 was off 20%. The worst quarter since 2008, and that really masks the extent of the decline. The S&P 500 was down 34% from that February 19th date to the current low of on March 23rd. And other segments of the market were even worse. The average stock across all capitalization spectrums was down 44%, and some sectors, energy in particular, across the capitalization spectrum were down 55 to 65%. So it's been a very rough quarter, and it's around the globe. It's not just the U.S. Global equity, broad equity index is also down 30 to 40% in that sell-off time period. And as you mentioned, volatility has been almost unprecedented. A couple of days right around the October 87 crash of the stock market were a bit more volatile than we saw in the late part of March, but that was an extraordinary week of days of more than 5% price changes every single day in the middle of March. So the volatility has just been really astonishing. And as you said at the very beginning of the call, unlike anything any of us have experienced. And we had been seeing volatility settle down in the last 2 weeks or so prior to this week starting, and here we are up 2,200 points or so from Friday's 2,200 points from Friday's close on the Dow. So volatility has resumed to the upside a little bit in the last 2 days.
Well, we'll take the volatility and the upside all day long. Thank you. And you know, one thing that we've talked about as a team is that, you know, there's this theme that's been with us for really a few years now, also is prevalent in this, you know, this six-week period that we're talking about where you have growth stocks doing better than value stocks, large-cap stocks doing better than small-cap stocks, and U.S. doing better than international. What is behind this continuing trend, you know, in up markets and down markets, and do you think it'll continue going forward?
It really has been an unusual trend when you look back at longer periods of market history. And what what's behind it really is that growth around the world has been precious over the last part of this economic cycle. And the U.S. in particular has been pretty resilient in displaying some growth, even though growth rates have been slowing. And especially U.S. corporate earnings growth has been better than elsewhere in the world, and led by some of the stalwarts of current U.S. industry, the Amazons and the Apples of the world. So dollars, of course, have been chasing those high-quality companies and bidding their prices up relative to everything else. Coming through this crisis, that's also been most the trend has been mostly the same, that the higher quality, stronger, higher growth rate companies have outperformed in most of the crisis. Now, a little change just in the last couple of weeks since the bottom. We've seen a little bit of outperformance by value stocks over growth stocks. Some of those value stocks were beaten down, especially hard, so you would expect a little bit better rebound in a rebounding market like this. But as far as looking ahead on that kind of on those kinds of trends, you know, the importance of diversification is you might be wrong about something. So you own more than one stock, more than one investment in your portfolio because you might be wrong. And while this dominant trend of U.S. growth is we think still in place, you want to deal with market uncertainties and make sure that you have exposure to other things to help offset the risk that you could be wrong. And as we move out of this crisis environment and we move on to the next economic cycle, there's eventually going to be a return to what we would call normalcy, but it's very hard to pinpoint when that return comes.
Yep. Well, and I'm gonna ask you a really difficult question. And look, I realize that you know, your answer is dependent on containment and successful antiviral treatments. But you know, what do you think is going to happen for the stock market as we move forward?
Well, we've as I've said a couple of times, there's been a little bit of a settling down of all this and a bit of a rally. As a matter of fact, I think the S&P 500 is up 20 or so percent since March 23rd. I would expect that as we get into the next couple of weeks, corporations will be reporting earnings for the first quarter, and investors will be getting a chance to look deep underneath the details, and maybe we'll get some guidance from corporations. They've been very reticent to offer guidance in this very uncertain environment, but as we get into earnings season, maybe some guidance will be issued, and then as we get further into the quarter, as Paul described earlier, we'll be getting more economic reports to get a sense of really how this contraction is moving. I'd expect, you know, we're going to experience more volatility. And if it turns out that this virus the flattening of the curve turns out to be really happening, maybe we'll get a chance for high side surprise, but it's a little too early to bet on that yet. So probably in the next, in the immediate future, more volatility with the chance of a little bit of an upward flare if news turns out to be good. But if it turns out economic reports show that things are worse than expected, we probably haven't seen the end of all this.
All right. Well, thank you, Martin. That was a tough question. And as I said, there's a lot of variables, you know, that can determine the outcome as we move forward. So, Jeff Tangus, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
Jeff is our Director of Fixed Income. And Jeff, you know, equities get all the headlines, as you've known your whole career, but there's a tremendous amount of movement in the bond market. Talk a little bit about what's happening on that front, if you could.
Sure, be happy to. Well, the bond markets are a little bit more opaque. You can turn on the news and see what the stock market did that day, but not so much for the bond market. March was a month all about flight to quality for bond investors. And it was an extreme example of a flight to quality, which means that investors really, they didn't just want to hold treasuries. They wanted to hold cash. They wanted to hold U.S. dollars. They didn't want bonds in general. They didn't want corporate bonds. They didn't want muni bonds. They wanted to hold U.S. dollars. And it wasn't just U.S. It was all around the world. People were obviously scared given the declines in the equity markets, and they wanted to hold cash. Consequently, almost everyone was a seller of bonds during the month of March. There really weren't any buyers. And so the markets, the global markets, got overwhelmed, and they froze up. Even the treasury markets itself started to struggle because of the onslaught of selling. Well, in a situation like that where everyone's a seller and there really aren't any buyers, there's only one buyer, the buyer of last resort, that's big enough to bring balance back to the market, and that's the Federal Reserve. And as Paul indicated earlier, the Federal Reserve showed up, and they showed up in a big way, thankfully, because they were the only one who could actually bring stability to the market in March.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. And Paul touched on it. The Fed's been really, really active. And provide some of the details around the programs that they've implemented, the key ones, and how it could maybe provide some support not only to markets but the economy as well.
Well, the Fed fortunately had a playbook from the 2008 financial crisis, so they didn't come into the whole situation cold. And Jay Powell, to his credit, really moved swiftly and dramatically. And they pulled out the playbook. The first thing they did, most people are aware of, they dropped interest rates, short-term interest rates, the Fed funds rate, twice to 0%. And that really sent a signal to the markets that the Fed was engaged and ready to do whatever it takes. The second thing they did was announce a massive quantitative easing program that's kind of being dubbed the QE4 program. And that was about $700 billion of treasuries and mortgages that they were going to buy. They quickly amended that to basically unlimited buying so that they said, we'll do whatever it takes. Just last week, they bought over $300 billion in treasuries in the open markets in just 1 week. That was like an entire program in the post-credit crisis world, the 2008 crisis. So a huge effort there on their part. And because the credit markets were freezing up, they really needed to implement a kind of a litany of emergency programs they used in 2008 to backstop critical areas of the bond market. And I'll just name them. They backstopped the primary broker-dealers. They backstopped the commercial paper markets, the municipal and the prime money markets.
Oh, there you go. I lost service for a second.
Central banks and swap repos around the world. And then also the $4 trillion Main Street lending program that is really going to go a long way to stabilizing small business. So that's a summary of the numerous programs.
Great. Thank you, Jeff. And so far, seems to be successful?
Well, interest rate volatility has declined dramatically. Corporate bond spreads have quit going up. They started to show some signs of declining. Municipal interest rates are coming back down again. All these are good signs that we're at least moving back in the direction of normal. There's still lots of areas of concern, but in general, the fear factor is declining.
All right. And lastly, Jeff, just if you could, maybe a little bit of an outlook for the bond market as we move forward.
Well, as generally is in a case like this, there are lots of things that you know and there's things that you don't know. What we do know is that the Federal Reserve is going to do whatever it takes. And so short-term rates are likely to stay low for a long, long time. We know that the Treasury is going to have to borrow trillions of dollars just to pay for the CARES Act. We were already borrowing trillions for a deficit budget. But the Treasury will borrow about $1.2 trillion just this quarter. So the Treasury is going to be issuing lots of bonds to pay for things. And that means that while short rates may stay very low, longer-term rates are likely to trend modestly higher. The Fed's not going to let them move dramatically higher, but with all the supply coming in the market, it's reasonable to think that longer-term rates are going to drift higher as the Treasury brings supply. So not dramatic changes, but certainly stability on the short end with gradually rising rates on the long end.
All right. Jeff? Thank you, everyone, for joining us this morning. Our team is regularly putting out content on what's going on in the market and the economy. We do a weekly summary piece. We send out a monthly investment perspective. And if you'd like to get on that mailing distribution, please contact any Hancock Whitney associate, and we'll make sure we'll get you included on that list. Also, our next call, monthly call, and hopefully we don't have any special update calls between now and then, will be on May 5th. Please join us then. Thank you.
This conference is being recorded. Only the main conference is recorded. Conference recording has stopped. Your conference is ending now. As requested by the host, please hang up.